For 85 years, the United States Forest Service has been charged with overseeing the nation's vast wealth in timber and wildlife. The agency had heroic beginnings, founded to save wild lands from the depredations of the robber barons. It remains the second biggest landowner in America, with nearly 10% of the country in its care. But today, the service finds itself assailed from all sides. Environmental and logging interests, the public, and one of the most vocal critics is 12-year forester Jeff DeBonis. After criticizing the service from within for its close ties with the timber industry at what he believes is the expense of a vital and fragile ecosystem, DeBonis quit the service to found the Association for Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations on KUAC-FM. Today, we'll talk with Jeff DeBonis about his views and the direction he thinks the U.S. Forest Service must take to protect America's old-growth forests. Jeff, can you start for me by giving us an historical sketch? When the Forest Service began, Teddy Roosevelt was in the White House. A man named Gifford Pinchot, who was a forester, was much on the scene. What happened to cause them to think we needed a Forest Service?
Actually, it started even before Gifford Pinchot got on the scene. The Federal Reserves were withdrawn by Teddy Roosevelt and the Congress in just, I think it was 1891, when the Federal Reserves were first withdrawn. And the reason that they withdrew those lands was, as you mentioned in the first paragraph, the robber barons of the era, through various scams and illegal uses of various homestead acts and public domain land giveaways, had basically cut over and got control of huge, vast acreages of public domain land. And so the Congress and Teddy Roosevelt at the time said, we need to withdraw some of these public domain lands to preserve these forests for two main purposes. The original withdrawals were for watershed protection, and the second was for biological sustainability. They didn't call it ecological sustainability back then, but they did actually mention biological uses into the future. They wanted these lands to be preserved for watershed and biological considerations into perpetuity, into the future. And so they withdrew these lands, and at the initial withdrawal, they did not allow any timber cutting at all. Now, then the 1897 Organic Administration Act was passed that formally established the Federal Reserves, and it had the same purpose, was to protect the lands for watershed and biological sustainability, as well as provide a continuous supply of timber products. Now, that additional bit was put in there because of tremendous pressure applied even back then by the timber industry. But still, they had some controls on it. And the controls under the 1897 Organic Administration Act was that each tree would have to be individually marked, and that only old-growth, dead, dying, over-mature trees could be cut. Now, in the initial first part of this, okay, I'm going to back up a little bit. In 1907, the Federal Reserves were transferred to the Department of Agriculture at the request of, the pushing of Gifford Pinchot, who became the Forest Service's first chief of the Forest Service. Again, that was, I believe it was in 1907. And so Gifford Pinchot became the first chief. That was in 1907. And we had the first Forest Service, national forests were established. And in the first part of the century, even though Gifford was sort of a wise use person, he wanted to see the national forest produce timber as well as the other resource values. It was only to be done if it could be done on a sustainable basis. And so they were very much in a custodial management mode in the first part of the century, partly because there was so much private land and timber industry were at the time was pretty much cutting on their own lands. And they really didn't want competition from the federal sector. So there wasn't a big push to cut timber on the national forests. Even though they were authorized to do so, there wasn't much of a push for it in most places. So the first part of the century, the Forest Service remained in that custodial management format, where they pretty much protected the forest from disease and wildfire and illegal grazing and that sort of stuff. It was after World War II, when private industry had pretty much cut through most of their private lands, and we had a housing boom of the early 50s. People were coming back from the war. They all wanted their own house, and you know, there was sort of that population surge, that we started getting pressure from the timber industry to increase access onto the national forests. And this pressure was made through Congress. And Congress and the Forest Service and industry all pretty much agreed that it would be a good thing to increase access to our national forests and increase the amount of timber cut.
Can I ask you why at this juncture? Were there an insufficient amount of forest in private lands, in
yes.
private hands?
Yeah, at that point, private industry had pretty much cut over their private lands, and they were looking for more supply. They needed more supply to fuel the housing boom of the 50s.
So the Pinchot's theory that any cutting had to be sustainable cutting
yeah.
within the
right.
public lands was not something that the industry had applied to private lands.
No, absolutely not. Industry has, for the most part, this is a gross generalization, but industry, for the most part, in a general sort of overall look at the United States, have not managed their lands on a sustainable basis. And in fact, I've even got quotes in here from people in BN, which is the it's Burlington Northern's Plum Creek is their industry spinoff, their timber industry, timber cutting resource exploitation spinoff of Burlington Northern Railroad. Plum Creek executives have even been quoted as saying that we were never on a sustained yield basis. We never intended to be on a sustained yield basis. We don't intend to cut on a sustained yield basis. They cut to market demands. Short-term profits is what motivates industry.
You're listening, if you've just tuned in, to Jeff DeBonis, who was 12 years a forester with the U.S. Forestry Service. He's founded an organization called the Association for Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics. Why not? I mean, if you are in an industry, logic says that you're going to be in that industry for 50 years, so why isn't it logical to plant as you cut or not to strip cut an area?
Well, actually, sustainability is not necessarily implied by not strip cutting or just planting. I mean, you can overcut your forests and have them all in 20-year plantations, for example, and that's not sustainable. But what I'm talking about is sustainable in this manner is that you cut in a way that by the time you cut your last acre, the first acre you started on is now ready to cut again. Okay, that's what I mean by in this definition of sustainable.
Okay.
Sustained yield is what we're talking about. So what industry has done is they've cut so fast that much of their land is now all in young plantations and they won't be ready to cut again for maybe 20 or 30 years. So there's a gap in terms of their supply. And what they've been doing is pressuring the public and Congress to have increased access to our national forests while their second growth forests get to a point where they can be recut.
And is it just a basic optimism about abundance?
No, it's a basic greed, I would say. What they're responding, and some people would say demand, okay? And in the case in the Northwest, the demand is coming from a booming export market. So we're talking about an absolutely unfillable demand. They can cut as fast as they possibly can and never fill the total demand that's out there because of the export market. Now, the thing that's changed in the last 10 years with timber industry is that the accountants in their head offices in Chicago and Miami and New York are looking at forests as a 5% annual return on investment. What that means is that the biological capacity of these forests is basically only going to provide you with 5% annual increment, annual return to your investment. What this means is that if you have an unlimited demand, i.e. the export market, then you can convert all of these standing forests, cut them down, sell them, convert that money into capital where you can reinvest it in other sectors of the economy at a much higher interest rate. And that's exactly what the big companies are doing. Burlington Northern, Weyerhaeuser to some extent, Louisiana Pacific, they're all cutting their lands right now as fast as possible because those standing forests are undervalued capital, and they can convert that into, you know, cash and invest it in other sectors of the economy. If they don't do that, then they're liable to become a hostile takeover target, which has happened to a company in Northern California called Pacific Lumber. They were what you might call a model of restraint and sustainable forest management in the private sector. They had an excellent program of pay. You know, they had very good wages to their workers. They had a very good pension plan, and they cut their forests on a very careful, sustained yield basis. They literally did not cut more than was growing. And what happened was, when you do that, you have a lot of standing forests. Again, forests don't grow very fast. So if you're cutting them on a sustained yield basis, and you're looking at, say, an average in the redwoods of a 200-year rotation, you're not cutting very many acres a year, percentage-wise, of your total forest. So you end up with a whole bunch of your forest standing there, only providing 5% per annum return on the books. What these hostile takeover magnates see is that they can cut all those forests down.
The unsold inventory.
The unsold inventory, and then reinvest in other sectors of the economy. So the Maxim Corporation, which I believe was, I can't remember which Wall Street raider now it was. It was one of the infamous Wall Street raiders, and his Maxim Corporation did a hostile takeover of Pacific Lumber and are now in the process of initiating huge clear cuts at an extremely fast rate to pay off the junk bonds. And they've also sold the pension plan of the workers as part of that. See, they get the whole package. And what is typical of these hostile takeovers is they start selling off pieces of the company. And one of the pieces they sold off was this excellent pension plan of the workers. So, I mean, here we have the classic case of a timber industry that is just run by absolute bottom line, quick profits and greed. And while this is an extreme case, there's elements of this case throughout large timber corporations in the United States and their management scenario.
Let's go back for a minute, because I asked questions that kind of led you away from what I was thinking about. When I led you away, you were talking about what happened after World War II and in the 50s, a transformation in our logging industry.
Where we started increasing access and increasing the amount of logging on national forests. Mm-hmm. This continued on increased access, increased cutting on national forests throughout the 50s and 60s. Now, in 1960, Congress realized, and the public was becoming a little bit concerned about increasing the increased cut on their national forest, and they were beginning to see some of the downsides of that. They were beginning to see some of the damage, some of the loss of recreational areas, some of the loss of wildlife habitat, some of the erosional damage that was happening, you know, all the sorts of downside to accelerated timber cutting. So Congress passed the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act of 1960. And what that said to the Forest Service was, yes, manage for timber, but give equal weight to all the other resources. That means fisheries, wildlife, watershed, recreation, soils, all of those other resource values you're supposed to give equal weight to. Well, the Forest Service pretty much ignored it and kept on doing as they were doing, increasing the cut.
There was a tremendous demand with the baby boom generation.
Exactly right. Tremendous demand and tremendous pressure on Congress to keep increasing access. The problem was that the Forest Service acquiesced to this. They didn't stand on that old professional ethic that Gifford said was that, yeah, we'll provide timber, but only if it's absolutely sustainable. The Forest Service got into this industrial mode of thinking where they felt that it was sort of maybe the era of abundance sort of concept, where they felt that technically they could overcut now, but they would improve their stock, their growing stock, and they would do fertilizing and do all of these technological wonders to make trees grow faster. So they probably felt that they were actually, they could cut more than was actually growing because they anticipated faster growth in the future.
The period of the 50s and 60s was a tremendous period for technological advances,
exactly.
Plus an optimism that we could do almost anything.
Exactly right. And that was certainly part of the what was going on with the Forest Service then and increasing the national forest cutting. So then we got into the 1970s, and that's when the environmental movement really started picking up ahead of steam. And in 1974, a historic law case was filed against the Forest Service by the Isaac Walton League in West Virginia. And the Isaac Walton League said that the Forest Service was cutting illegally because it was mostly clear-cutting. And under the 1897 Organic Administration Act, it said that you could only cut trees that were individually marked and that were dead, dying, and old-growth, decadent sorts of trees.
Back to Teddy Roosevelt.
Right, back to Teddy Roosevelt. And so by clear-cutting, the Forest Service was violating the Organic Administration Act. Now, the Forest Service's response to that was, well, we've been doing this, violating the act for 60 or 70 years now, so we have precedents. And I don't, you know, they didn't think the court was going to rule in favor of the plaintiffs. Well, what happened was that the district court ruled in favor of Isaac Walton League and enjoined the Forest Service from any more clear-cutting in the Eastern District. And what that means is that other environmental groups around the country could use that law case as a precedent and basically could have stopped clear-cutting across the United States on national forest lands. At that point, the Forest Service became very concerned, timber industry became very concerned, and they decided they needed new enabling legislation to allow them to do, quote, modern forestry techniques, i.e. clear-cutting. And so we got the 1976 National Forest Management Act, which authorized, among other things, authorized the Forest Service to clear-cut, and so superseded the Organic Administration Act. Now, the 1976 National Forest Management Act is what's called discretionary legislation. It doesn't have very prescriptive standards like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. Those acts have very specific measurable standards. When an agency or a perpetrator goes beyond those standards, then you can sue them and you win in court. The discretionary legislation, like the National Forest Management Act, basically says that the professional agency, in this case the Forest Service, are the professionals, and that we're going to give them a wide amount of latitude on how they interpret this law. So most of the 1976 National Forest Management Act is just sort of broad guidance, and it allows the Forest Service to interpret the specifics of how to manage under that.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar to the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act. And what we've had in the last 15 years since 1976, NIFMA, I'll call it, National Forest Management Act, was passed, is again the Forest Service ignoring the spirit and letter and intent of that piece of legislation. So we're in a situation right now where we have numerous court cases against the Forest Service based on the National Forest Management Act that in many cases the Forest Service is losing. And that's significant because under discretionary legislation, unless the agency is way out of line, courts rule in favor of the agency and their discretion. When we start seeing environmental groups winning under the National Forest Management Act, it means that the Forest Service is so out of line, they're not coming anywhere near meeting the spirit and intent. And this is, in fact, the case of what we're seeing right now. For example, the spotted owl lawsuit that Seattle Audubon Society filed in 1989 against the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management in Washington and Oregon. They won an injunction against the Forest Service because the Forest Service was not meeting its obligations to protect the spotted owl, which is a biodiversity provision in NFMA, as well as the Endangered Species Act. So there are numerous examples. We could sit here for probably 2 hours, and I could give you specific examples of how the Forest Service is not meeting the spirit and intent of that law. The reason it's not is that it has decided to use its wide range of discretion in favor of the resource extractors, in this case, in favor of timber industry. There's no doubt in my mind that the Forest Service, to put it bluntly, is in the pocket of timber industry. They have been since World War II, in my opinion.
Let me remind people who've just tuned in. This is Jeff DeBonis. He was 12 years a forester with the U.S. Forest Service. His job has been was for that service in timber sale planning, field preparation and administration for timber sales. He served the Forest Service in forests in New Mexico, Montana, Idaho, and Oregon. He is the president and founder, co-founder of the Association for Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics. We'll talk a little bit about that organization later on. I want one more economic piece to the puzzle here before we move to the rest of our thoughts. When did exports of timber come into play, and what balance of sales do exports take now rather than domestic sales? Are they a major player, export sales?
They are. Let me back up a little. Exporting has been going on for a long time, but the export market has really picked up in the last probably 5 or 6 years, where demand overseas has really increased. And in terms of, from our standpoint here in the United States, there's probably we probably could not totally fill the demand that's being that we're seeing in export. So we could probably export as much as we wanted to. We could probably cut down every forest in the United States right now, and it would all be exported at a high, you know, with under, you know, it's such a high demand. But they don't actually make sales for export. In fact, there is a law that says that federal timber cannot be exported. This is federal timber in the western United States, from about Idaho and Montana on west. It's illegal to export federal timber.
Like the Jones Act is to oil in Alaska.
Exactly, but there's some loopholes. And one of the loopholes is that a private company, if it had always been exporting a certain amount of its own timber, could substitute federal timber for the amount it exported. So in a way, you know, they export their own and then they buy federal timber. That's the export markets having a direct effect on demand for federal timber. Also, that only applies to raw logs. Federal timber that is what's called partially processed can be exported legally. Partially processed may mean taking off one or two slabs off the side of a log, and that's partially processed, and then they can essentially export that raw log. All they do is just take a couple slabs off. So, and then there, the third part of that export puzzle is that lots of federal timber gets exported illegally. And in fact, I saw some figures back about a year ago that there's a fairly significant percent of federal timber that's exported illegally. And it's fairly easy to do. I mean, you think about a large company having sources of timber from several areas. You know, who's keeping track of all of those logs coming in and whose logs are what, you know, and it's easy to get to cook the books and export, you know, illegally export timber. It's not a hard thing to do. At any rate, that's not even the main problem. The main problem is that the fact that our private timber can be exported without any restrictions. And in fact, in Oregon, as much as 25% of the timber cut in the state is exported. That's one out of every four logs is exported. And what that amounts to in terms of, in comparison to, say, how much timber is cut on federal forests, the export last year was at least 4.5 billion board feet of raw logs. Now, the entire cut on Oregon and Washington's federal forests is about 4 billion board feet. So it's roughly equivalent. The amount that's being exported is roughly equivalent to all of the trees being cut on federal lands. So when timber industry use the argument that environmentalists who are trying to protect federal lands and trying to protect the spotted owl are causing the supply shortage is pure BS. Because if they were really concerned about supply, all they would have to do is stop exports. Now, if we were to protect all of the land that was that we need to protect the spotted owl, we'd probably be looking at about 1/2 to 3/4 of the amount that's being exported. So we could more than make up for spotted owl habitat by banning raw log exports. Now, if you want to expand that concept and look at raw wood exports, which includes not just the raw logs, but these cants I mentioned, mm-hmm. these sort of logs that just have one or two slabs off them. And if you include pulp and chips, the amount is almost three times the raw log export, about 12 billion board feet of timber a year, which is equivalent to the entire cut of all trees on federal national forest across the country. So if you look at the export, just the export equation, you throw a whole different light on supply and jobs and the issues that are affecting the Northwest today in terms of this industry propaganda scheme that's trying to pit loggers against owls and environmentalists against the timber industry. It's really a red herring, and it's not a fair propaganda war at all. It's not truthful.
How did you become the renegade forester? I assume that 12 years in the service, you didn't start out thinking things were wrong.
Well, actually, I did. I came from the Peace Corps in El Salvador. In 1978, I started working for the Forest Service. And my job in the Peace Corps was working with poor peasant farmers on these very steep hillsides. They were trying to cultivate on these steep slopes, cultivate corn and beans for basically to feed their family for that year. So we're talking hand-to-mouth survival sort of survival cropping. And what we had, of course, was very steep slopes and soils that were laid bare under the cultivation process, and then heavy rains coming and washing all the soil down into the streams, destroying riparian areas, causing massive erosion, silting in behind their electricity dams, you know, their mm-hmm. large dams for electricity, and so really having a lot of damage in the environment and on the infrastructure of the country. So what our job was to try to slow down this process of erosion by doing certain planting and terraces or contour planting and building terraces out of rocks or sort of real simple conservation tools. At any rate, that was the scene in El Salvador. When I started working for the Forest Service in Northwest Montana in 1978, I got there, and my first week in the field, we went out and looked at this timber, at all these timber sales, and we had the exact same scenario. We had 70 to 80% slopes, very steep. We had clear cutting, burning, and then planting little trees about 8 or 10 feet apart, leaving large, vast areas of the slope exposed. And then in some of these drainages in the Northwest Montana, we were looking at rainfall of 60 to 100 inches a year. So we had the exact same situation that we had in El Salvador. And my first intuitive comment to these people was that, you know, I just came back out of a third world country. We were trying to tell them not to do this, and here we are doing the exact same thing here. Aren't we getting erosion? I mean, it looked to me like we were getting erosion and getting a lot of sedimentation and damage downstream. And they said, no, we know what we're doing. This is in modern industrial forestry. There is a little bit of damage, but it's tolerable. It's not that bad. So me not having had any experience in industrial forestry in the United States, I accepted that, you know, with reservations, but I accepted it and gave myself time to sort of go through the learning and experiential process to see if this was true. And what I found over the next couple, 3 years on the Kootenai is that it certainly was not true. We were having major damage. I know I was exposed to numerous areas where soil erosion had caused sedimentation and damage to downstream fisheries. There were areas, numerous areas of washouts, small streams in the headwalls of drainages that literally washed out to bedrock because of clear cutting and exposed soil and exposed to rain on snow events, they call them, where you get lots of snow and then you get a warm rain and you get this big rush of water and it just takes out the whole drainage. So we were getting lots of damage as a result of our cutting practices. And over time, I began to see how much other damage that wasn't as obvious as well, damage to wildlife habitat, fragmentation, damage to threatened and endangered species. We had grizzly bear habitat on the Kootenai, and there was always this push to keep, there was this attitude, this mindset, as I mentioned before, of always trying to get the cutout and trying to ignore or downplay the damage that this was causing. And so I got into this, I started to see firsthand the conflict that was going on between, say, the wildlife biologists and the timber planters on the districts and on the forest, where the wildlife biologists and these other resource specialties who knew and understood the damage that was happening to their resources, how they were sort of pressured and made to comply with the bureaucracy's goal of getting the cutout. And so it became very evident to me that the Forest Service was not this protective public trust, public interest agency that I had been led to believe it was. It very was much in the pocket of timber industry. A good example is just the Forest Service's attitude toward, say, timber purchasers who come in to find out information from the Forest Service versus an environmentalist who comes in to find information. I mean, you can just feel the difference, the hostility toward the environmentalist, the warmth and sort of the feeling of this is an ally when timber industry come in. And that's been true no matter where I've worked. And there's numerous other examples like that where, you know, when you're inside, you kind of understand and feel the culture that the Forest Service is very pro-industry and very anti-environmentalist. If you look at, for example, a regional loggers association meeting, you'll oftentimes find Forest Service employees at these loggers or miners association meetings. And yet if you go to an environmental meeting, you go alone. And in fact, if they find out you've been there, you often get pressure or ridicule for having been to an environmentalist movement meeting. So you really see the difference. You really see that the Forest Service is not in the middle. It's pretty much on the side of industry folks.
You've said that the owl and the environmentalists tend to become the scapegoat.
Yeah.
And are put in the position of the scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
How, why, and how to get out of that? It does seem, I mean, one tries to ask questions without bias, but it does seem, from your perspective in any case, that a balance of cutting and sustaining of forests is what will get us into the next century and the century
yes,
beyond that.
Exactly right.
So why particularly are owls and environmentalists, bunny huggers, being scapegoated?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things, it basically boils down to, in my opinion, timber industry propaganda war. Timber industry wants to continue cutting at an accelerating rate on national forests. Now, if you want to get down to very specifics on why, it's because the national forests are the only places where old growth is left. In some places, it's the only place where timber is left. They've already overcut their own lands. But this idea that they want to get the last of the old growth is based in the fact that industry has lots and lots of inefficient old growth mills scattered around the West. They want to amortize those mills as quickly as possible, i.e. cut the remaining old growth that those mills can only cut as quickly as possible so they can retool or dump those mills and move to second growth technology. The forest of the future, we're looking at 60 to 80 year rotations, which are small diameter timber. We're never going to see this old growth again. Timber industry is pretty much wanting to amortize those old growth mills as quickly as possible, which means cutting the remaining old growth on federal lands and moving on to second growth technology. So there's a lot of sort of internal strategy in terms of where industry is going in the future in this fight over the old growth. They figure, why have the old growth strung out over 20 years if we can get rid of it now in 10 years and be done with it? And that's part of it. And the other part of it is that, as I said before, they've gone through their own lands and they want, you know, they're insatiable. They just want more and more timber. In many places, there's more mills than the local timber economy can support. And in the last 20 years, when we were overcutting, we were able to support all these mills. Well, now that we realize that we have been overcutting and we're going to have to scale back, someone's going to run out. Some of those mills are going to have to fold up. We can't support all of them. So there's this battle that, you know, well, if we can just keep the cut on the federal forest high, then we can keep all these mills running. So it's basically runs down to they want that supply.
Hmm. Do you see from your experience in Ecuador and El Salvador that the forests of the United States are moving towards their present and their future? Are we in that kind of danger?
I think in the long term, we are. And I know that lots of foresters would argue with me on this point. And here's why.
Try and give me both sides.
Okay. In the tropical rainforest, where I've worked also, I worked in Ecuador with USAID. In the tropical rainforests, the ecosystem down there is quite a bit different. When you cut a forest down there, you immediately move into, very quickly, if you clear cut extensively, the forest cannot regenerate itself. And the reason why is that all of the nutrients are stored in the overstory of those tropical rainforests. So when you cut down those forests, there's not a deep enough soil to store the nutrients that was in the overstory.
You say in the overstory, are we talking branches?
Yeah, the biomass above the ground.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is in the tropical rainforest, you have a very, very rapid nutrient recycling system. As soon as something dies, all those roots down there immediately take up, and of course it's warm and humid, and so decay happens very fast, and those nutrients are released quickly, and there's so many roots and stuff down there, they suck up those nutrients really quickly. It doesn't stay in the soil very long, in other words. So the nutrients are continually recycled above ground very rapidly. And then when you clear cut down there, what happens is there's nothing to recycle those nutrients. So those nutrients get washed out with all the rainfall down below the thin humus layers on top, and those nutrients become unreachable by the next forest. So what you end up with is like scrubby grass sort of stuff that is not very productive. You really do lose the forest quickly when you clear cut in the tropics. On the contrary, in the temperate area, we do have deeper soils. And when you clear cut an old growth forest, you lose lots of nutrients, but not all of them. There's enough nutrients left that you can grow a second growth forest. So instead of getting immediate deforestation, you get slowly debilitating deforestation. And what we're finding in the temperate areas is that it takes maybe 3 or 4 managed rotations to get to the point where the soils are so depleted that they can't grow another one. So what we're talking about is a longer time frame. The same process is happening, but it's not happening as quickly, and it's happening over a longer time frame. And so if we continue to manage as we have managed under, quote, industrial forestry techniques of the last 30 or 40 years, we are in as much danger, I believe, as the tropical rainforests. It's going to take longer to happen, but we're eventually going to get there. What we do have time, though, to do is that we have time now to understand that the industrial forestry practice of the past are causing this slow, debilitating drain on our forest lands, and that we can start rectifying that now before we lose the total capacity of those soils and those ecosystems to respond in the future. We have time now to change it. And what that would entail would be perhaps longer rotations. It would entail leaving more, this is some of the new forestry information now that's coming out, this new forestry research that Dr. Jerry Franklin has been working on for several years. It would entail leaving more large organic woody debris on site, and it would also mean leaving more trees on the site, instead of clear cutting, leaving lots of green standing trees of different age structures on the site to continue through to the next rotation. Now, what we don't know is how much of the structure we have to leave. In my opinion, we're cutting too heavily, even under the best scenarios of the new forestry regimes. We're talking about leaving maybe 30% of the stand. I think we should be more conservative and start off with leaving maybe 60 or 70% of the stand. And then and sometime in the future, we're going to know where that break is. We're going to know how much of the stand we can take out and not damage the long-term sustainability of that forest. At this point, we're only guessing. We do know that we haven't been doing it right in the past. We've been clear-cutting and losing lots of structure and losing lots of nutrients and losing lots of soil. What we know that we have to do in the future is leave quite a bit of that stand intact. At this point, we don't know where the breaking point is, and that's going to just take more time and more research. But I think it's incumbent upon us to be as conservative as possible. If we don't know the answer right now, let's damage as little of the ecosystem as possible until we do know the answer. And what that's going to mean is we are certainly going to have to lower demand, not only in the United States, where 5% of the population consume anywhere from 30 to 40% of the world's resources, but it's going to take an international effort and cooperation to start reducing demand as well and start redistributing what wealth is available. We simply cannot continue on in this mode of the first world countries hoarding the wealth and the third world countries getting by on a tenth or a hundredth of the wealth that we're using. It's that disparity cannot go on, not in a world community. We have to start thinking as a world community, and we have to start thinking in terms of the biological capacity of these ecosystems. We have to start living on the interest of these ecosystems. Biological systems can produce a certain amount over their direct need that we can harvest. What we've gotten into now is that we're cutting into the capital of those systems. In other words, just like a bank account, you can live on the interest and have that bank account last forever. Or you can start eating into the capital, which means that in the future there's going to be less and less interest and less capital to supply interest. And we're in the situation in the world now where our biospheres are under so much extractive resource pressure that we're definitely cutting into the capital of those resource systems. And we're in a situation where it seems like we're wealthy now, but we're taking away from basically our future generations' capital stock. They're going to have less interest to live on in the next generation.
In what form? Less interest to live on?
For example, if you overcut a forest and it dies and it turns into a desert, there's less and less forest available for them to harvest products out of in the future on a sustainable basis. If you look at agricultural land, we have over-harvested and over-cropped many lands, and in some parts of the world, we're turning that into desert. So there's less cropland now for a larger population tomorrow. And if you look at converting minerals into toxic pollutants, what that's doing is polluting the atmosphere, polluting our water supplies, polluting the ocean, so that each of those biospheres are going to be less productive because of the pollution. The more air pollution we have, the more damage occurs to forests, the less productive those forests are. The more pollution we have in the ocean, the heavier we strip mine the ocean via drift netting, the fewer stocks are available to produce food in the future. And so what we're doing is, while our population is growing, we are diminishing the capacity of the planet to provide services, goods, and replenishment to the human and other species on the planet.
And what do you say to this? One understands your call, but the call is coming in a time when not only our nation, but other developing nations of the planet are becoming more and more voracious.
Exactly right. And so we have to get beyond this demand and constant growing demand viewpoint. We have to get to the point where we truly distinguish what is needed to survive and what is extraneous to survival. We don't need, let me just give you a really just simple, gross example. Every person in the United States should not be driving a car. We should be looking at public transportation to reduce the amount of gas and oil, to reduce the amount of resources going into these huge vehicles. Let's look at packaging in supermarkets. We don't need to be wrapping everything in three layers of plastic. I mean, these are just really simple off the top of my head things. Let's look at energy consumption. The United States uses twice as much energy per unit output of industry production as any of the other Western countries. And so you just get an idea of all of the waste and consumption that we're doing. We simply don't need to buy and consume as many things as we do in the United States. We're at the point now where we don't buy for need, we buy because it's a pastime. Consumerism has become a pastime. And so it's become the central tenet of an economy that says that demand is unlimited and that wants are unlimited, and we are going to fill those demands and needs no matter what. And what we're doing is we're tearing the planet apart in filling these consumer demands. And if you look at, you go into a store, 90% of the stuff in there is unneeded and many times unwanted, and most of it will end up in a garage sale or in the trash in a year. Those are not life's necessities. We have to start focusing on what is truly meant by quality of life and not quantity of material things. And this materialistic ethic that has been promoted in Western cultures has got to be turned around. There's just simply no ways around it. It's the central tenet of our economy, and it's something that has to be changed.
You're listening to Jeff DeBonis, our guest today on Conversations for KUAC-FM. He is currently the president and a co-founder of the Association for Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics. It was founded in June of 1989. He is also the editor of AFCES, that is the acronym, newsletter Inner Voice. The organization is based in Eugene, Oregon. As Mr. DeBonis has mentioned, he was in the Peace Corps and also the U.S. Agency for International Development, serving in Central and South America, and was 12 years in the Forest Service as a timber sale planner and administrator. There was an article in the New York Times in March of 1990. The author said that some top scientists of the Forest Service currently believe, as you do, that the government is wiping out the biological archives of the old forest. Can you tell me what is meant by a biological archive?
Certainly. In old-growth forests, particularly those in the Northwest, in the tropical areas, and in the Southeast as well, a lot of these old-growth forests are extremely complex. They have evolved and have numerous and myriad life forms that are all interdependent on each other. I'll give you an example. There's a fungus called a mycorrhiza, which helps trees grow. It works in conjunction with tree roots, and it provides the trees provide sugar to the mycorrhiza fungus, and the fungus help the trees get moisture and nutrients from the soil. So they're interdependent. Then there's like little types of voles that help spread the mycorrhiza fungi around to other places. The voles do a very specific job. They eat these truffles and these other funguses and spread the mycorrhiza and other funguses to other parts of the forest. And in cases where you have like fires or natural disasters, they recolonate the soils with these mycorrhiza fungus. Now the spotted owl is dependent on the voles. And so you end up with this incredible chain of interreaction and interdependency within these old-growth forests. Now, when you cut these old-growth forests down, burn them, and plant monocultures of Doug fir, you lose numerous components of that system. Now, if you do that on a small scale, like it happens in natural pre-colonial history, where maybe 20 or 30% of the entire old-growth forest was in some sort of disaster stage, then there's enough surrounding areas that can recolonate those burned areas or those hurricane blown over areas with these organisms. The situation we're in today, say for example in an old growth forest, is that only 10% of it's left. 90% of the old growth forest has been cut down and reconverted to, in many cases, monocultures of single species trees. Those areas have lost much of the what we call the biological legacy of those old growth forests. We've lost the voles, maybe. We've lost the spotted owls. We've lost some of the fungi that only exist in those old growth forests. Again, if we'd only done this on 10 or 20% of the area, it would probably recolonate and repopulate. We've reversed it. We've got like 90% of the old growth forest converted. So the remaining 10% is all that's left. And of that 10%, some of it is so highly fragmented that it is considered biologically dysfunctional, which means that it may not survive as an intact ecosystem into the next couple of centuries. It may die out.
Vital players are missing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the vital players may be present in this 10%, but there's not enough of a genetic interplay that we can guarantee their survival into, you know, 500 years from now. So that's what we're talking about losing. When we simplify these ecosystems under our management systems, we lose much of those biological components of the forest. And the problem was we never saw those things before. We didn't realize they were there. We didn't have the knowledge. We didn't have the research. We used to think that old growth forests were dead, dying, and decadent, and that if we cut them down and planted healthy little trees, we were doing the earth a favor. We were doing ourselves a favor. That was just out of ignorance. It wasn't out of maliciousness. It was out of ignorance. Well, now we don't have that. We can't rely on that ignorance anymore. Now it is out of greed, out of just not wanting to change, the inertia of not wanting to change our past practices. Timber industry to this day, at least in their propaganda, at least in their public campaign against environmentalists, refuse to acknowledge the value of these old growth forests. They still think that, and they still proclaim that when you cut down these old growth forests and plant Doug fir, that they are reforesting. They are retreeing, but they're not reforesting. And that we can't even agree on that definition. That's much of why the debate is still raging and why the public feels confused, is because environmentalists and scientists cannot even agree with timber industry on a basic definition of sustainability, of the wealth and value of old growth ecosystems, and the fact that we've impoverished these ecosystems by converting them to single or near monocultures of plantations of Doug fir.
And so contrary to the quip that President Megan may still regret to this day, a tree is not just a tree, right?
Exactly right. We were never aware of all the other aspects and functions and underground functions of these old growth ecosystems. We just thought they were dead trees, dying trees, and that all we had to do was plant healthy trees and we'd have a new forest, and that simply isn't the case. And that's research that's coming about largely a result of people like Chris Mazur and Jerry Franklin, forest ecologists who've been working on these old growth forests for the last 20 years. It's new data, it's new research, and it's led to new values. I mean, in the old days, in the 60s and 70s, there were lots of environmentalists who intuitively knew that these forests had value. They intuitively knew they were much more complex than science was giving them credit for. But because of our Western philosophy and culture, unless we can prove it, unless you have the numbers and the data to back it up, they just dismiss that all that stuff as woo-woo, you know. There is nothing to base it on. Well, now science is backing up the woo-woo. Science is backing up these intrinsic, intuitive values that we knew were always there.
Yeah. What do you think the Forestry Service has to do now? I want to rephrase that. How do you think the Forestry Service has to think? And from this new mode of thinking, what do you think it needs to do in the future?
Oh, that's a good question. What I think the Forest Service needs to do is change its basic attitude. And let me just get real specific about this from my own experience. The attitude of the Forest Service now is that we're going to keep cutting, we're going to keep developing, unless you, biologist, hydrologist, timber sale planner, can prove to me beyond a reasonable shadow of a doubt that this damage that you say is occurring, and if you can't prove it in a court of law, so to speak, then don't bother me with it. We're going to keep studying it, and we're going to keep cutting at the same time. The shift we want to see is a more conservative value system that says, if we don't quite know what we're doing, if we're not sure that we're going to not damage this ecosystem, if we're not sure that we can protect all of the parts of this ecosystem, we won't cut and we won't change the ecosystem until we're sure that we can manage without damaging these parts of the ecosystems. It's a fundamental shift in values in terms of being more conservative in our approach of our public trust lands. In other words, if we don't know what we're doing, we back off. We don't keep cutting.
But how likely is that? I mean, the Forest Service has been of a very firm other mind, in your own words.
Well, that's true in the management arm, but it's not true in the research arm. if you look at forest researchers, they've been sort of saying this for a long time. And if you look at the National Forest Management Act, we already have encoded in law that basically tells us to have this conservative mindset. It tells us we're supposed to be doing the research and monitoring to ensure the state and health of these ecosystems. So what that implies is that if we don't have the research and monitoring, we should not be doing anything that would impair the health of these ecosystems. And in fact, the original 1897 Organic Administration Act encoded also into it this concept of sustainability, of biological sustainability, and of other resource protection in watersheds and wildlife and that sort of stuff. So it's already been encoded in law. I think it's my opinion and the opinion of many people that the Forest Service is breaking the law in its current mode of operation. So what we're asking the Forest Service to do is start using its discretion under the laws that it already has to start meeting the spirit and intent of those laws and start becoming a much more environmentally conservative organization. Start really looking at the research that our own Forest Service scientists have developed and start using that as the basis of our management. And that if we don't know what we're doing and we don't, and we know that we're in a critical situation, for example, in the old growth forest of the Northwest, where only 10% of them remain, I mean, that should be a red flag warning right now to say that we are not going to cut any more old growth, period. And that is something that the Forest Service could do today under your existing legislation. It might be not be the politically best thing to do in Washington, but we need a chief and we need someone in management at the top who's willing to take these kind of political risks. And I think with the public's awareness of environmental concerns today and the fact that the environmental community would be there to back them up and many people in the Forest Service would be there to back them up, I think that management today could make that kind of a shift and survive politically and do it. But even if they couldn't survive politically, that's no excuse to not do it. But it just so happens that I think that they could survive politically and do it. So it would be a very good win for them. What we want to see the Forest Service do is start reliving its history, is start regaining its stature as a leader in a new conservation ethic. It used to have that stature. It used to be known as the leader in public trust management, in a leader in as a conservation ethic, a leader in that sort of protection and conservation of our forests. Now that we have new data that shows us that we need to change our management, the Forest Service could again become a leader for a new conservation management ethic for the 21st century, which would be much more conservative in terms of management practices than we are now. They could become an international model for this kind of public trust land management agency. And we have the research people to back us up. We have the ethical, knowledgeable people in the agency that would want to make this shift. We simply need to start doing it. It's going to take some political leadership to do it.
And what about the future of the logging industry?
Very good question. I think what we're going to see is more pressures by the public to have to make the logging industry start managing their private lands on a sustainable basis. No more of this succumbing to resource to endless resource demand via the export market and liquidating huge, vast tracts of private lands so they can export it at a quick profit. We're going to start seeing attempts to curb the rapacious, savage capitalism, so to speak, that we see on our national forests. There are social and environmental values that as a society we should be demanding even of private landowners. And there are certainly environmental costs that we should not be passing off to the next generation. And we're seeing this very thing happen with private timber industry land management. They're literally liquidating huge vast tracts of forests, causing untold damage to watershed, wildlife, other social and environmental values, and they are totally destroying any basis for community stability of those communities that are dependent on those forests, like loggers, into the future. So in terms of destabilizing communities, logging-based communities, timber industry has been the worst offender for the last 150 years of doing that. And so as a society, we should make a determination that we're going to put some constraints on private land management that will ensure at least a sustainable, sustained yield sort of management on private lands. And the future of the logging industry, I believe, rests with the environmental community. I think that loggers have the same long-term goal and vision of sustainable land management as environmentalists do. And particularly on private lands, I see a greater effort at ecosystem rehabilitation, forest rehabilitation, and then entering an era of enlightened, sustainable management on private lands as well as public lands. Truly sustainable, not this fake BS sustainable that they're talking about now, where they keep lowering the rotation age and then cutting more acres.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see the role of your organization is in this future you're describing?
Hopefully, our organization won't be needed in the future because the changes that we're advocating will be internalized by the agencies like the Forest Service and other public trust agencies, and we won't need this watchdog change agent instigator sort of organization. Hopefully we'll work ourselves out of a job. What we'd like to see is that these agencies start doing the leadership role that we're talking about, and so they wouldn't need this sort of spark plug activist sort of group inside them.
You've only been around for a year plus a few months. When do you see yourself working yourself out of a job?
I'd like to say 3 years, but I don't know. I certainly hope that these changes are instituted within 5 years, because if they're not, we'll have lost so much of the intrinsic value of functioning ecosystems on our national forest that it may be a moot point at that point. But what we'd like to see the Forest Service, we'd like to see the Forest Service's mission, primary mission, change from what it is now, which is is resource extraction, into one of an ecosystem research rehabilitation restoration mode. And on our public trust lands, that would be the highest value and highest use of our public lands, is to provide functioning ecosystems to the next generation, whose major job is going to be ecosystem restoration.
Does the Forestry Service have any responsibility to oversee private land?
Yes, they have a state and private extension sector of them, which we could, one of the things we would like to see is that the Forest Service becomes more heavily involved in private extension. In the lower 48, non-industrial private lands, which are not big corporate timber industry lands, but smaller private landowners, there's lots of those timber lands that are mismanaged or not managed at all because of tax disincentives, and in some cases because they're competing with federal subsidized timber. As an agency, we have a lot of expertise on how to grow timber fast and how to manage for fiber. And we could start subsidizing the private sector instead of subsidizing federal sales off of our federal lands, where they're competing with all these other values that are found on no other timber industry lands in the United States. We could start shifting this subsidy toward the federal, to the private sector, and use the Forest Service as sort of an extension agency, just as we have the Soil Conservation Service being an extension agency of expertise to farmers. We could do the same thing to timber farmers on the private sector.
One last question. Are you optimistic?
If I wasn't, I wouldn't be bothering with all of this.
Thank you, Jeff DeBonis.
Oh, thank you.
Once again, this gentleman's credentials, he is the current president and co-founder of the Association for Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics, an organization founded June 89, based in Eugene, Oregon, responsible also for the newsletter Inner Voice. Jeff spent a couple of years in the Peace Corps and USAID, U.S. Agency for International Development, in Ecuador and in El Salvador, and 12 years with the Forest Service as a timber sale planner. He is now, as I said, the president of the Association for Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics. Thank you for being with us today on Conversations.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Good. Been an interesting hour. And for our listeners, join us again next week. I'm Susan McInnes.